I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Welcome, everybody, to Mike TV, episode 23, in which we will be covering HBO's Watchmen, season 1, episode 3, entitled, She Was Killed by Space Junk. My name is Lisa. Joining me, as always, is Dean. Hello, Dean.
Hey, Lisa. Definitely someone could have been killed by the space junk we saw in this episode.
Yeah, there's a lot of space junk in this episode. I'm excited to talk about it. But hey, guess what?
Yeah?
We have an email address.
What is it, 1998?
Well, we love the Twitter engagement that we're getting, and we're hoping to increase that by throwing an email out there. So if you have thoughts on Watchmen, even past episodes, anything you'd like us to read on the air, please email us. It's miktvpodcast@gmail.com. That's miktvpodcast@gmail.com.
Awesome.
We'll answer all emails. Please, again, any speculation, any ideas about Watchmen, anything you're loving, anything you're hating, anything you love or hate about us. You know, it's cool. Just let us know. And also, tell us about other shows you'd like us to cover or that you'd like to recommend to us. You may be surprised. We might already be watching them.
Dum, dum, dum.
So, but we don't have time to get into all the other shows we're watching today, although there have been some great ones this week. We want to get into what was far the best show of the week. She Was Killed by Space Junk, episode 3 of HBO's Watchmen. How'd you like this episode, Dean?
I liked it. It was, I said last week that they did a good job not going too far off the deep end for people who may not be in tune to Watchmen, but then they kind of ramped that back away this time because they've gone, it is a full Watchmen show now. And
100%.
A lot of weirdness in this, or at least things that it definitely added a lot of questions, but mm-hmm. I thought it was great. Very Lindelof-y type of episode where we are starting to see that maybe moving on every episode is not just going to focus on Angela, which is kind of what it seemed. We have like a Laurie-centric episode, and so maybe hopefully moving forward, they'll progress the story by kind of looking at the eyes or through the eyes of other characters.
And it was a great episode. Laurie is just when you thought no one could be cooler than Angela, and along comes Laurie. Blake. Oh, I have so much to say about her. I'm excited to talk about her.
Jean Smart crushed it.
100%. Jean Smart was perfect. Emmy award winning. Emmy, seriously. Just that one episode alone. You know, I wanted to talk, too, before we dive into the episode, about the HBO Watchmen official podcast. Finally put out an episode. That's exciting. It was an interview with Damon Lindelof. Did you get a chance to listen to that?
No, I haven't. I've heard it's only going to be 3 episodes, and they're going to release one every 3 episodes.
Correct. It's a really good listen. I highly recommend it. Listen, we know there are lots of other Watchmen podcasts out there. We listen to them, too. We enjoy them. This one was no exception. Lindelof did kind of talk about this story being in 3 parts, and the podcast, you know, being something that they'll do after every 3 episodes. So it was really interesting, things we kind of already knew, but just hearing him say the words about how he really wanted to keep the source material canon and pay real tribute to that source material. And that he was super careful. He turned the opportunity down twice before he even finally said yes. And he's keeping it canon, you know, so we could appreciate that for sure. So everybody listen to it when you get a chance. That's the HBO official Watchmen podcast, something like that. It's out there. All right, well, let's dive into the episode here.
Yes.
Another great title screen opens the show right away. This time it's a phone dialing, like a phone booth, push button dial tone, dialing out the words Watchmen. And we hear, or we kind of see that a person who we now know, of course, is Lori Blake. We don't even need to dance around it. It's Jean Smart, y'all. She's in a blue, glowing, futuristic phone booth. And they do pan outside and show the exterior of the phone booth. And did you catch where this is? Not there. Oh, hey, look who it is. Look who it is.
Oh, it's my podcast arch rival.
Yeah, I heard y'all doing a podcast in here.
Tim Andrews.
Getting close right there. Is this being recorded or is this just blank video?
We're live right now.
You're on.
You're live where?
Well, I can see you live.
Well, no, I know you can see me, but this isn't streaming.
No.
No, but you're live on my computer right now.
Oh.
Isn't this how it works? I'm watching it live.
So, yeah. This is my favorite podcast about The Watchmen.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah.
And I am not able to comment on this episode because I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to watch it this weekend.
Well, there's a big blue surprise for you when you watch it.
Is it a dick?
It's dick-like.
Well, you know.
Ooh, don't spoil it.
Well, I want something to look forward to, like a giant purple dick or blue dick.
You've already been spoiled.
No, I haven't spoiled it. Unlike the people I spoiled Terminator for who got mad and unfollowed me.
Oh, man. Poor John. Poor John.
Watching it, Tim.
Have you seen it yet?
No, I'm not going to go see it, but I read the spoilers for it.
So did I, and then I watched Red Letter Media tear it apart.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, this isn't a Terminator podcast, but we're glad Tim Andrews is watching Watchmen.
Yeah.
Which is canon, by the way. All right. bye.
Later, Tim.
Well, that was fun.
Oh, Tim can't figure out his way out of the room.
No, he's got to navigate through my house. Hey, all right. Well, that was a little drop-in from Mr. Tim Andrews. We appreciate that very much. That was exciting. Back to the show. So that phone booth, if you notice the pan out at the exterior of that phone booth, and it's just so close to where I live, but that was actually downtown Decatur Square. Right here in beautiful Georgia. Did you recognize that? I know you don't live near Decatur.
I didn't recognize it as Decatur Square, but I mean, knowing that it looks like, you know, many, many a town squares in Georgia, whether it's Jackson or Covington or Decatur. Yeah, it definitely has those same building styles and everything.
And what was interesting is they didn't change a lot of the building marquees. And that's what made me recognize it, is because it clearly had the Iberian Pig, which is a real restaurant in Decatur Square. So we actually get three shots of this, so I'm going to point it out every time. And frankly, I'm just going to say we're the only Watchmen podcast that pointed out that scene took place in Decatur, Georgia.
Boom.
There you go. So, yeah, this is a phone booth making a transmission to Mars, we come to understand. And Lori Blake, a.k.a. Jean Smart, starts to tell a joke into the receiver. She starts the joke about a bricklayer who's a perfectionist and decides to teach his daughter step by step how to build a barbecue in the backyard.
Oh, I thought he was building a wall. Were they building a wall?
Barbecue.
Oh, okay.
And when it's completed, he realizes one brick has been left out and he is about to tear the whole thing apart because he's such a perfectionist and can't handle the fact that he doesn't understand how this brick could have been left out. And the little girl stops him and throws the brick up into the air as high as she can. Oh, but wait. Shit. She messed up the joke right there in the middle and wants to start another one. So this is a voiceover as Jean Smart, a.k.a. Lori Blake. I'm going to go back and forth with those because we don't really know her as Lori Blake yet. But this is a voiceover as we see Jean Smart walk into a bank and begin to rob it. And as she's robbing it, a masked man who looks an awful lot like Batman drops in, and we see just when we think he's about to save the day from her robbing the bank, we see it's this big role reversal and that all the people in the bank are actually the FBI, including Jean Smart. And it was just a setup to take that masked vigilante down. It was all just a big trap. And then as he's trying to run out of the bank, Jean Smart shoots him. And everybody starts to stare at her. And she just defiantly says, "What?" And then as she's leaving, another guy asks her, how did she know his body armor would stop the bullets? And her face kind of gives it away that she really didn't know that. But we do know that he's not dead. He's okay. And we do see her handcuff him to the gurney. And then there's a crowd in the street yelling, "Set him free. He's a hero." And she says, "He's not a hero. He's a fucking joke." Mm-hmm. So how'd you like this opening title this opening sequence here?
I thought the opening scene was filmed awesome. It reminded me of, you know, I got Dark Knight vibes of the opening bank robbing scene, or like Heat, that type of thing, where the way they film her feet coming in and walking through the bank. And, you know, all of a sudden it surprises you that she's shooting the gun up in the air. And because the previews have shown her as an FBI agent. So at first when she's robbing the bank, I kind of thought maybe this is a flashback before she became an FBI agent or something. So I like the way that they kind of pull the wool over your eyes as far as what she is and what her role is, and mm-hmm. that she's actually there to catch the superhero. I like the subtle dig at the Dark Knight or Christian Bale's Batman.
Yeah.
Even with the growly voice.
Yeah, it was a fun scene. And I guess really we should talk more about the joke as a whole at the end, because the joke carries through the whole episode. Right. In fact, I actually thought about when I was making my notes, just saving the whole joke till the end, but it's important. I guess it's kind of a three beat joke, if you will. Yeah. And really the points in time that the joke is but done as a voiceover, and the points at which it stops are kind of at a nice stopping or pivotal point in the episode too. So they're really juxtapositioned quite well with one another. So we'll follow the stream of the joke as we go through the episode.
Okay.
Yeah, I liked it too. I really loved seeing Jean Smart on my screen again. Of course, we loved her as Melanie in Legion. So
I thought it was interesting that the crowd was in favor of the superheroes. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, most of the original Watchmen comic, the superheroes have gotten so out of hand that the people tend to not like them. And now we're starting to see maybe that even though they're vigilantes and it's illegal, the people are actually more behind the concept of the masked vigilante as opposed to the cop.
You know, I didn't study that crowd very clearly, but I guess it's safe to say that maybe there were a mix of people in the crowd. You know, both for and against, right?
Yeah. They just definitely were very much focusing on the one guy who was like yelling at her and called her a fucking pig and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one in every crowd.
Yeah.
All right. So we see, and you know what I also want to just say about what this show is doing so well is they've put an older woman into this role and they're not trying to make her look young. You know, she looks her age. She looks fabulous, by the way. And it's a celebration to how stunning older women can look without trying to be made to look young. You know,
right.
I don't know if she's had any work done, but she doesn't look like she has. You know, she just looks healthy and vibrant and beautiful for her age. And
well, and the way her character is, I mean, even in Legion, even though she was kind of in charge of I can't think of the original place they go to.
Summerland.
I was like, Soundgarden, Summerland, Summerland, yeah. She was in charge of Summerland. She never really seemed like very actionable. You know, like she didn't seem like she was a mental leader, but was never really getting it in down with people. And then even the last two seasons, she was basically subjugated to being a really crappy character. You know, just a...
Yeah. She didn't get to see a lot of action.
Yeah. And then this one, she's a total badass.
Totally. And a total smartass, too, which really appreciate. So we'll get to that for sure. Okay. Well, cool. We're going to just gush about Jean Smart probably through this whole episode. So hang on, everyone. So then she walks into her apartment. Of course, we know we're not in Oklahoma. Presumably, we're like in D.C. or near FBI headquarters, right? Right. So she walks into her apartment and she says, "Start Devo," which is a band Dean, do you know about Devo?
Devo, they're, yes, I do. Whip it good.
Okay. All right. Just making sure.
Hey, I pulled that song. That's on my little trailer in Radio Labyrinth this week. I know who Devo is.
They had other songs too, but
people my age love the 80s.
Okay.
We weren't there.
Yeah. Well, people my age lived the 80s. So yeah, Devo, of course I love Devo. And actually this is an homage to the title. Actually, I'll just say it, where she walks into her apartment and says, "Start Devo." And this is where we see the title card on her wall. Of course, in that Watchmen font, she was killed by space junk. And that Devo song, either that's playing when she says, "Start Devo," or the album that is playing has a song on it called Space Junk.
Yeah, I believe that song's called Mongoloid.
I don't know Devo well enough to know either of those songs, but they certainly have a unique sound. So I knew you could tell it was Devo, distinctively yeah. Devo, but I didn't know that song. But I did read that they have a song called Space Junk. So that's first little homage to that title, or to the episode title. So then she says hello to her pet that is behind in a cage behind a cover over the cage.
What'd you think it was? I thought it was God's third creation.
Mm-hmm, I did too. I was like, not another one. No, we learned soon enough. It's an owl. So we'll just go ahead and say it's her pet owl. She feeds him a mouse. And then we see her use code 667 to open a mysterious briefcase that has a blue glowing light coming from it. And she gets a very longing look on her face with this briefcase. Oh, but there's a knock on the door. So we're interrupted from learning more about that briefcase. I definitely got a Pulp Fiction vibe from that.
I even think that because in Pulp Fiction, I think the code is 666, right? And mm-hmm. so I think it was almost, I think they purposely made it 667. So you would think it was about to go there. And the way they filmed the combination. And so almost Pulp Fiction, but just a nod.
And I also thought, are they going to do like Pulp Fiction and not show us what's in that case?
Oh,
like,
no, they're going to show us.
No, they show us. Don't worry. But yeah, that was a great, great little tie in there. So there's a knock at her door and look, it's Senator Keene. Boy, he gets around. He wants to come in. So she lets him come in and he asks her the name of her owl, which is a funny response from her. She says his name is who? Ask him. And then he tells her that she needs to go to Tulsa to investigate the chief of police who has been hung, and she corrects him, it's hanged. And she angrily tells him that perhaps that he shouldn't have put cops in masks. So we're starting to learn that this whole thing that's going on in Oklahoma with the police department was Senator Keene's idea and his plan that he put into action.
Yeah, well, we mentioned it last week that he is, because remember, his dad is the one who actually made the Vigilante Act, the Keene mm-hmm. Act that made the vigilantes illegal. And then he made the act for Tulsa to where they could wear the mask. So it's almost like he's bringing them back.
That's right. And then he even gives it the lovely acronym DOPA, which she hates and thinks it's, she's like, DOPA. And he says that is the Defense of Police Act. And then he affirms that masks save lives. And then she very wisely realizes that he's doing all of this because he wants to become president.
Oh, yeah.
And she tells him as much. And then he says, you know, a man who is president can pardon anybody he wants. He can even possibly get your owl out of his cage.
Right.
And as this is happening, we can see an Andy Warhol style piece of artwork behind hanging on her wall behind her head. It is four classic Watchmen drawings. And in the bottom left corner is Dr. Manhattan, and the bottom right corner is covered up by her head just perfectly, but when the camera moves to the side, we could see it is her, Silk Spectre. Actually, Silk Spectre the second is the role that she played in the 80s, or who she was, I guess, in the 80s. And should we talk a little bit about Silk Spectre? For those who've seen the Watchmen movie, you should know all of this already. Silk Spectre the second was Dr. Manhattan's girlfriend. And also she dated Night Owl as well, correct?
Dated's a loose term. They banged a lot.
And that's who's in jail. That's who Senator Keene was referring to. We also know that Silk Spectre, Lori Blake, is the daughter of Silk Spectre the First.
Sally Jupiter.
Thank you. And also the comedian who is killed at the beginning of the Watchmen movie, correct?
Right.
And the comedian and Silk Spectre the First, Sally, had, I guess, a tumultuous relationship. And Lori did not take on her father's last name, which is Blake. Eddie Blake is the comedian. And she did not take on...
Well, she didn't know he was her father until she was... I mean, until really the events of The Watchmen. Because he... you find out through flashbacks he had raped Sally Jupiter. Then they actually had a consensual relationship after that. And she doesn't find out that he's her father until right toward the end of Watchmen.
Correct. And does not like him at that time. So we know we're 30 years into the future from the events that took place in Watchmen. So at some point, she decided to take on her father's last name, which is, I mean, reasonable. And also has given herself the moniker The Comedienne, which I don't know that that was 100% revealed in this episode, although she makes a ton of comedian-style jokes.
Yeah, she it's mentioned in the PDpedia supplements, but I'm sure we're going to see some kind of connection of that.
You think we're going to see Night Owl in jail?
I don't know if we'll see him in jail. I feel like at some point, because this is such a, again, a Lindelof thing to do, we're going to get an episode or at least a large chunk of an episode that is a dedicated like flashback connection of some sort and maybe see something there, whether it's either them or it's even, you know, other people reprising them as younger people. Mm. But he tends to do that kind of thing.
Yeah. He, you mean Lindelof?
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
True, true. All right, so back to our joke voiceover. So as remember where we left off with the joke, she wanted to start over. So this time the joke voiceover starts again and we see Lori heading to the FBI offices, kind of going through security and going into the room, you know, where they show the slide projection and details about the case that they're about to go start investigating. So this time the joke is three heroes are all trying to get into heaven and they're standing before God. The first one is dressed up like a big owl and he made a cool ship and lots of weapons. And God asks how many people that he's killed, and the owl hero says zero. And God concludes that he's too soft and sends him straight to hell, or snaps his fingers and sends him to hell. And that's where that beat of that joke ends, with that voiceover.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously she's talking about Night Owl.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we should kind of save our full analysis of that till the end.
Okay.
But I'd love the way they use this as transition, and I like that it always ends with the and snap, and like she snaps her fingers, and that's what cracks us to wherever she is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool way they transition there.
Great sound design. Trent Reznor's killing it with this. I've got some comments later on in the episode about that.
You think he's the one snapping his fingers?
I think he's doing all of the sound work.
Oh, yeah?
I do. I believe it. I'm sure he's got a team, but I'm sure he's overseeing it. It's just great.
Is he supposed to be doing all the Foley and stuff too?
Maybe I'm wrong about that. It wouldn't surprise me if he was, though. Okay. I'm sure we can find out.
Yep.
To be continued. Maybe, dear listener, one of you find out and email us at miketvpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, Trent, if you're out there, just drop us a line. Let us know what you did.
Yeah, Trent. Yeah, we love you, Trent. Okay, so... So Lori, at the end of this voiceover joke, ends up in the screening room, and the chief is showing the slideshow of the occurrences in Tulsa. And we see slides of Judd Crawford. He's talking about the occurrences on the White Knight. We see stuff about Senator Keene enacting the masked cops or starting that. And we see flashes of Judd Crawford. And also Lori sees a slide of Angela Abar as a police officer. And then there is this funny bit where the man who's working the slide projector, and we might as well just go ahead and say it now, we learn he's Petey. He's Petey of the Petey Files.
Old Dale.
Yes. And he inserts a slide with a letter from Rorschach's journal. And I did take a picture of that. So I want to read it real quick because it's great. But what it is, it's an entry from his personal diary. And the chief is so annoyed about it. And, you know, and he's like, is this 1985? I don't give a damn about nobody gives a fuck about Rorschach. Great. So, but this is the entry. If you pause and read it on your screen, it's a little hard to read. It's two entries, actually. The first one reads October 13th, 1985. First visit of the evening, fruitless. Nobody knew anything. Feel slightly depressed. This city is dying of rabies. Is the best I can do to wipe random flecks of foam from its lips. Never despair, never surrender. I leave the human cockroaches to discuss their heroin and child pornography. I have business elsewhere with a better class of person. And then the second entry is very dark. The second entry is October 13th, 1985, 8:30 p.m. Meeting with Veidt left bad taste in mouth. He is pampered and decadent, betraying even his own shallow liberal affections, possibly homosexual. So there you go. And I think we're probably the only Watchmen podcast that took the time to actually read that probably very unimportant journal entry.
I love the deputy director that's running the meeting. He's fantastic. The way he just is running through everything, the way he's explaining everything, even when he says, and then there's the sheriff in a tree, H-A-N-G-I-N-G.
Yeah, he was great. And he also has the line about how, he talks about how it was Keene's idea to start putting the masks on the cops, and who wouldn't want to have a secret identity, right, Blake?
Right.
And she just says, right, boss. So then he tells everybody that Blake is running point. They're all about to head out. Lori says she wants to go alone. Chief says she can't go alone, so she looks around the room and says, okay, I'll take him, and points to Petey.
Yeah.
So I love this duo. I love this team up.
Yeah, and I feel the only reason she picks him is because she knows he's so insignificant. Like, I don't even think at the moment she realizes that he actually has, like, knowledge about everything. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, well, you think that guy's a joke and you don't want me to go? Fine, I'll just take him. So you can say I'm not alone, but this guy won't get in my way.
I think she finds a use or two for him.
Well, yes, but I don't know if that she was initially thinking that.
No, probably not. So our next scene is Lori and Petey on the plane flying to Tulsa. Lori's sleeping with one of those sleeping masks that you wear when you're on the plane. And the announcement comes on that they're about to land and they need to buckle up. So she pulls the mask off and starts waking up. And Petey from the seat across from her pulls out a stupid mask of his own and shows it to her. She's clearly annoyed about it. Now, this is not a sleeping mask. She says that's not a sleeping mask. It has eye holes in it.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, well, I just thought I should bring it because, you know, the cops here wear masks. So, you know, when in Rome.
Yep.
She says, you're a federal agent, not the fucking Lone Ranger. And this was also a cool scene. The captain of the plane the pilot says that if they look out the window, they'll get a bird's eye view of the Millennium Clock. Mm-hmm. So we do see them looking out the window at this great structure out in the distance. And it's very futuristic looking, you know, I know we'll talk about that at the end of the episode because we see more of that in the next episode previews.
Yeah, Petey gives a little bit of a preview here too of Lady True, because talks about how she was the one that built that, mm-hmm. and even kind of dedicated it to Vite since she's the one that bought his company out.
Yep, she does. And then he does dig in a little with Lori and says, "You knew him in the past, right? When he was Ozymandias." And then he explains, when she doesn't really seem to want to talk about it, he starts to explain that he wrote his thesis on her and her ex when they were in DC. And by ex, he's referring to Dr. Manhattan. He clearly spells that out. And then he says, you know, he doesn't want to be treated like a fan, but he clearly is a fanboy. And finally, she says, yeah, she knew Adrian Veidt, and she too was not a fan.
Yeah, I think I think it happens twice during this episode, but this is the first time where I did get the feeling that as in control and kind of badass she seems, she does make mistakes because she does mistakenly misread him. Again, I think she picked him because she thought he was just some kid from the basement, and she almost dismisses him as like a little fanboy, like, oh, what do you want, an autograph type of thing? Like, yeah. Who should I make it out to? And then he basically just lays down that he's studied vigilantes, not just them, and he knows his shit, and like he's been, yeah, stuck in the boardroom running the projector, but
he's got like a PhD or something.
Yeah, and so I like that she kind of was like, okay, fine, you mm-hmm. know your shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe she's starting to warm up to him a little bit right here.
Ooh, yeah, well, once she saw that mask, I mean...
So the joke voiceover continues now, and this time the joke is, she goes on to talk about hero number two is now before God, and he is maybe the smartest man in the world, and he said that he saved humanity, and God asks, how did you do that? And he says, well, I dropped a giant alien squid on New York, and everyone was so afraid of it that they stopped being afraid of each other. God asked, how many people did you kill? And the smarty pants hero says, 3 million, give or take. But you can't make an omelet without breaking a couple of eggs. God calls him a monster and snaps his fingers and sends him to hell. At this part of the joke where the voiceover is, Lori is investigating the scene now in Tulsa. First, she's at the hanging tree where Judd Crawford was hanged, and she does spot the wheelchair tracks here and has Petey run over and take a picture of it. And then we also see her visiting Judy Crawford at the Crawford Mansion, and just the music throughout this whole scene in this whole investigation scene is just absolutely incredible. I don't know if you happen to take notice of it, but that was just some brilliant Trent Reznor work. And then there's also a really great shot of Lori as she walks up to the Crawford front door and looks through kind of the decorative metal door. You know, as she knocks, it's that decorative, that metal that you use on decorative front fancy doors.
Wrought iron and, type stuff.
Yeah, wrought iron. Thank you. And as Judy's opening the door, Judy or is it Jane? Dang it, I screw her name up every time. Sorry. Yeah. Why do I want to call her Judy? Is that the actress's name?
No, wait. Maybe it is Judy. Is it Judy or Jane? Now you have me confused.
I think it's Jane. Yeah. People are going to... Okay, write in and tell us. The Mike TV Podcast, Gmail. Well, how much we suck for calling her Judy. Okay. Anyway, Mrs. Crawford, as she opens the door, we do get that shot of Lori's eyes through pieces of wrought iron that are framed exactly like the comedian's mask.
Yeah, that was cool.
So any other thoughts about this joke? Clearly, we're talking about Ozymandias as hero number two.
Right. And it definitely seems to be leading toward or implying, at least for now, that, oh, it must be the three heroes. I bet it's going to be Night Owl, Ozymandias, and Rorschach standing in front of God, which would be Dr. Manhattan. So it's leading us somewhere, which is a good way, but of course it may not actually get there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was curious to hear who the third God was going to be for sure. So our next scene is, this scene was just great. Lori and Petey are watching from their car at an abandoned warehouse, and a Tulsa police van pulls up. And Pirate Jenny and Red Scare jump out, and they have a prisoner who's wearing a scarf over his eyes, so he's, you know, can't see. He's blindfolded. Thank you. I knew I'd come up with blindfold eventually. And we get this great scene of Lori walking up on them, and this was, of course, in the trailer, and it was just wonderful. She walks right up and says, "Hey, what are you guys doing here?" And Pirate Jenny says, "Well, who the fuck are you?" And she says, "Well, I'm Lori Blake. Who the fuck are you?" And just perfect, perfect line read right there. She starts to ask the prisoner, even better yet, she starts to ask the prisoner if his rights are being violated. And when he starts to explain that, yes, he is, in fact, she cuts him right off and says she really doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, that's awesome.
She's actually looking for Looking Glass. So that was great. So she's just a hard ass, badass, just no nonsense. I just love her. So she's taken into the warehouse, and there are tons of cops in there, and they're holding a lot of detainees who are all blindfolded. It's obvious Lori does not like or approve of how they're being treated. She's told Looking Glass is in the pod, and we see that there's the pod in this warehouse. And when Looking Glass comes out, this was a great bit. You know, he clears a guy that he's just been interrogating, and we see him wipe his... He's wearing his mask, but yet he still has a handkerchief wiping his brow. Like it was just brilliant. And Lori looks at him and asks if she can go next. She knows there's a line, but could she possibly go next? And inside the pod, Lori deduces quickly that the pod is actually a racist detector. LG doesn't like it being minimalized like that, but essentially that is what it is. Then she very hilariously uses the reflection in his mask to pick a seed out of her teeth. She's being very cavalier, finally tells him he can take that silly Wade off, or mask off Wade, or does he prefer Detective Tillman? Mm-hmm. So it's clear she knows his name and who he is, so he takes the mask off. And then he also... she asks about... Where is Sister Knight? He makes a reference to Sister Knight, and she says, "Oh, you mean Angela Abar?" And after some hesitation, Looking Glass does confirm that, yeah, that's true. That's who she is. And we learn that Angela took the day off to work on the eulogy for the chief's funeral, and Lori asks, "When is that?" "Oh, it's in a couple hours." Yeah. And so she says, "Well, I guess I better go change into something darker."
Yeah, this might have been my favorite overall scene of this episode. Just she completely breaks Looking Glass, who at this point has seemed like he has no emotional tells, has like completely always under control. And she walks in, immediately grabs up the remote and starts like flicking through the pictures. And he's just like, "Please don't touch that." You know? And then of course, like, she calls it a racist detector twice. And he's just like, "It's not a," and he like, even like kind of calms himself, 'cause you can tell he's getting frustrated. And she starts basically asking him questions that she already knows the answer. And what's cool is at first he's kind of fighting back, because he knows that every question she asks, she already knows the answers. And he kind of leads her to that, like, "Well, if you already read the report, you've already seen the video, and you know this." She goes, "Oh, yeah, you're smart." But when she does kind of just, I mean, she did it to him to begin with, but then once she's, Sister Knight, I mean, Angela Akbar, that look he gives, are just like, he feels like he's betraying her, even though he knows he's not, because she already knows, but just how he kind of even doesn't look her in the eye and looks down and says yes. And she just, again, asserts her will on one of the characters who have seemed like they're super strong so far.
And really, perhaps for the first time, learning, oh, my secret identity isn't quite so secret after all, is it? Yeah. It really seemed to be the first time he'd ever been faced with that realization.
Right. Especially from someone who he has no idea who she is.
Right. Right. Hey, man, that's the FBI. We've all seen Mindhunter and other FBI shows.
That's right.
Mostly Mindhunter, X-Files, I guess. What else is there?
I'm sure there's plenty with the FBI.
Okay. So we see her pull into her hotel, her accommodations. Did you notice that hotel's name, Dean?
Yeah, the Black Freighter Inn and Suites.
So the Black Freighter, for those who want to dive a little deeper into Watchmen material that's out there, but what the Black Freighter is for the Watchmen graphic novel is it's the comic book within the comic book. So it is a story within a story that somebody's following along or reading, some other comic book story about the Black Freighter. So that's how it ties into Watchmen. But there was supplemental material released after the movie came out on DVD. They released a secondary DVD with an animated short of the Black Freighter. And it's really good.
Yeah.
So that play, you can, I'm sure it's out there. You can find it anywhere and watch it. So yeah, that was a nice little Easter egg there. And then the joke voiceover now continues as Lori is getting ready for the funeral and driving to the funeral. So this time we go into the joke. It is hero number 3 is now standing before God. And this third hero, he is like a god himself. So to be able to tell them apart, we'll say that this one's blue and he likes to go around with his dick hanging out. And Blue God has real superpowers. And when regular God asks him about how many people he's killed, Blue God says, I know you're sending me to hell anyway because I'm already there. And so God does what he inevitably was going to do and snaps his fingers and sends him to hell. So yeah, third hero of that joke, this episode long joke, is clearly Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah, so I know we're going to, I mean, there's still one more set, but now the question is who is she mean by God?
I know.
It's I almost wonder if she just means just the simple judgment of fate, you know, like almost, it's not necessarily a person, but just they're all trying to make their own destiny or escape fate or be known as a hero, but at the end of it, you just are... You know, the heroes are always going to be looked down upon or they're going to be cast out into a trash life by the end.
Yeah, I would believe that that's a good assessment because these people are not happy people. They are not happy to be crime fighting, helping the world, helping save.
Well,
humanity.
And I mean, we, you know, Night Owl is in prison somewhere and Vite, we believe
we'll get to
is
him.
You know, in a weird place
for sure,
and Dr. Manhattan is lonesome on Mars.
or is he
he might be a 105-year-old black man flying around the world or something.
So this could be. Oh man, I hope we get some answers there. I know, and this is another thing that Lindelof does say in that podcast is that we are going to get answers on all of these things. So it's coming, people. It's coming. Patience will be a virtue in this case. So this voiceover is all going on. We see Lori and Petey are now arriving at the funeral. We get another shot of Decatur Square as they're driving into the funeral entranceway. And that's where she spots the blue phone booth. So this is how we know she eventually makes her way to it to make this call. And as they're entering the funeral, they're asked to turn over their guns. And Petey is saying, at first kind of starting an argument, but Lori just says, oh, come on, Petey, just hand over your gun. She hands over hers. But I will make a note that when they were getting ready back in their hotel rooms, there was a quick scene of Lori getting ready and strapping a gun to her ankle. So eagle-eyed viewers know at this point she possibly still had another gun, which definitely comes in handy in just a moment. So at the funeral itself, Lori and Petey are kind of standing off to the side. And Cal and Angela arrive with their kids. So Lori goes up, introduces herself to them. It's very funny when she introduces herself to Cal and he asks if he, you know, do you know me? And she's like, no. We've never met. She gives Angela her card and asks if they could grab coffee sometime soon. Angela says she's not a cop anymore. She retired 3 years ago. Lori says, oh, yes, yes, of course. I know. Yeah, it's so dangerous, mm-hmm. of course. Angela reads her card and sees that Lori is with the anti-vigilante task force. And then Lori proceeds to tell her a joke. How can you tell the difference between a masked cop and a vigilante? Angela says she doesn't know. And Lori says, me neither, and chuckles. Hey, yeah. So that was a joke within a joke.
Right.
Within a joke.
Another attempt of this, again, of her just trying to completely blindside these people and just pure power play, you know, like even like in introducing herself to the husband. So basically, mm-hmm. like, I know everything about you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, you're retired. Yeah, like, it's very clear she knows exactly who you are. And it appears that Angela is kind of taken aback by this.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, Angela's not used to anybody coming up and being aggressive or straightforward with her at all. So the funeral starts, and it is, I guess, a little strange because Jane calls Angela up essentially to do the eulogy, and it gets even stranger. As Angela starts to speak, of course, we, the audience, start to hear a clock ticking, which this was great, too. We know something is happening here. Yep. We also see a brief shot of a man in a Rorschach mask crawling through a tunnel. Angela explains to the crowd that she and the chief, because they had both been shot at the White Knight, that they made a pact that they would both speak at each other's funerals and be prepared because they saw so many cops die unprepared. So she has a prepared speech that Judd wanted specifically read. And I guess she was the steward of ensuring this would happen. And then it just seems a little bit inappropriate. She unfolds a piece of paper and starts singing this very weird song with lyrics about how I'm heading for the last roundup. And by the way, she does not sing well, and that's not a dig. I don't sing well either. So she's not in key or anything. It sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's an old Gene Autry song.
I figured it was something. I mean, you could tell it's about, like, you know, like rustling up the cattle or whatever.
Yeah.
But the chorus is so terrible. Get along, little doggy, get along. And then that's just repeated. Get along, little doggy, get along. Just seems like a very strange song to sing at a funeral. And it got even stranger and more appropriate when everybody started clapping along, which Lori initiates the clapping. So what did you think of the song and the clapping?
I don't know why you're laughing about it. I thought it was a beautiful, I almost Aww. Cried during this part.
Like, geez,
it's a song about, like, a cowboy making their last ride, or it can be an allegory for your last ride up to heaven type of thing. And it was written in the 1930s or early 40s. So get along, little doggy. Like, that's what, that was the thing that they said.
I know, but it just didn't seem appropriate for a 2019 funeral to
in
be
Oklahoma.
Get along, little doggy, maybe.
Yeah, that's an Oklahoma thing.
It was very bizarre. Well, I'm glad you were moved by it. I thought it was
funny. You're supposed to be the sentimental one out of us.
I know. I wasn't sentimental.
I even thought, I was like, oh, I bet Lisa's balling at this point.
Oh, goodness. They'll probably get me at some point through this show, but it hasn't happened yet. So as this get along little doggy song is going on, the masked bomber, who the Rorschach mask, walks out of a tomb from across the way, walks over to the funeral with a trigger in hand. He's got a bomb jacket on. Clearly this is what they were building with all those batteries. He says the device is connected to his heart, so if his heart stops beating, it'll go off. He calls Senator Keene, of course, who's in the front row of this funeral. I forgot to mention that. He calls Senator Keene a race traitor and demands that he surrender himself or everyone dies. This ominous clock ticking and this tense music in the scene is just incredible. And then out of nowhere, the man is shot in the head and falls over. And we pan over and see it was Lori who shot him. And then the bomb jacket countdown begins. And Angela screams for everybody to run, which they all do. And she drags this was great. great moment too. She drags the body with the bomb that's about to go off and dumps it into the grave hole. And then the casket that has Judd's body in it, she pushes over on top of it and runs off just in time as the bomb goes off and everything just explodes. She gets away, but Judd's body, not so fortunate there.
No, he ends up saving the day after all, jumping on the grenade. I thought this scene was awesome. The actual scene after the shooting happens with her pulling the body and pushing and she is a great actress, but I got the feeling that they had her drag, if not an actual guy, and put him into that hole, a like life-like dummy that was heavy enough, because she just looked like she was straining with all her might and trying to be as fast as she could, but you could tell she was straining. And then it looked like they may have had her literally push a heavy casket, because it was kind of already onto the side. Mm-hmm. So like, but like, all right, you're gonna have to do this, because I mean, the strain on her face, the tension that was there, it was awesome. She looked strong, and but still like working as hard as she possibly can. I did think it was weird that no other officer helped her, but that I think was just to show her how strong she is. Right. But I thought it was very tension filled.
She screamed for them all to run, so they did.
I know.
But it would not surprise me. Not that I, you know Regina King on first name basis or anything, but I believe her to be a strong enough, good enough actress who is in touch with her craft, that it wouldn't surprise me that she probably asked for those props to be real heavy or lifelike, so that she could show that level of strain.
Yeah,
realistic.
And then Keen, of course, all too eager to immediately step over and be like, no, it's I'll do whatever you want. I'll do whatever you want. And then how shocked he was when all of a sudden this dude's head gets blown off.
We need to talk about Keen for sure at the end. In fact, we do have an email with some questions about Keen. So we'll talk about Keen because, he was willing to just give himself up. Could this have all been something that was maybe staged and then went horribly wrong because of Lori Blake's secret gun? Or horribly right, perhaps, because, you know, we don't want to let them get away with that, clearly. All right, now the moment we've all been waiting for. We're going to go over to Veit's place. So we're going to take a little break from the action in Oklahoma and go someplace who knows where. And first we get a great overview of Veit's workspace in his office. And we see lots of plans and drawings kind of scattered throughout the room and all kinds of like old timey kind of implements and, you know, nothing modern at all. But there is a nice flash over or pan over of the squid plans. Did you see those on the ground there?
Yep.
And anyway, we do see that Veit is designing a suit of some kind. And finally, in this, some goofy song is playing. It's a kind of a nice little montage. But throughout all of it, throughout all of his suit building, he's assembling it and, you know, carefully tanning skin and finding just the right metal pieces and even the glass dome off of his little terranium there. So he's using, you know, found household items that you only find in a castle, really. But he's got all the pieces he needs. Finally, we see the final suit being assembled onto Mr. Phillips. And Veit is very excited to be putting this plan into action. Mr. Phillips says he never doubted him. He never doubted you, Master. And Veit says, that is because, Phillips, you are incapable of doubt. But I appreciate the sentiment anyway. Then he asks him if he's ready to go into the great beyond. And Mr. Phillips says he's ready, Master. And then the next shot we see is him frozen. Mr. Phillips is frozen dead on the ground. So clearly it did not work.
Yeah.
And Veit gets very pissed off, throws a huge fit, kicking, screaming, all kinds of obscenities. And then he concludes that he needs to make a thicker skin suit. And he goes off to hunt some buffalo.
Well, you even missed where, I mean, he says that to another Mr. Phillips who wanders over while he's kicking the skull in of the old Mr. Phillips.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny. He lets out his anger, but then he's just like, that's okay. It's like, you know, he just gets his stress out by kicking this dead body, and then it's okay. Put him with the others.
Yeah, this was this made me really believe that he's not on Earth. Wherever he is, he's trapped in some. And I kept, because the camera in his office showed that terranium with the dome over it so many times, I really felt like that was some sort of meta contextual item put in there as a prop to kind of show the domed world that he's living in.
And they do show a quick flash in the promos of this, where if you put this together with when they are scanning his office, you see a little miniature like catapult. So I'm thinking he is literally catapulting these guys into the sky through whatever this dome may be. And that's why he ties the rope around him so he can pull him back. But
what if he really is in that dome, much like Melanie and Oliver were really just in the flower pot?
Yeah. It's his giant ice cube.
That's another Legion reference. All right. So he was saying all of this to another Phillips who just, you know, has no emotion at all about this other dead Phillips on the ground. And we really get this full scope of landscape as he's out shooting buffalo. He's riding around for miles and miles, and we really just understand how alone he really is there. He does shoot a buffalo, though, and as he's going up to, I guess, skin it, he is shot by a man in the distance whom we learn is the game warden, and that man prevents him from skinning this buffalo. So he's pissed. So he trots on by, rides back to his house, and hilarious moment as he enters his house. There is Crookshanks and Phillips holding a cake, this time with three candles.
Yep.
They are starting to sing for He's a Jolly Good Fellow again, to which he just storms past them, grabs the cake, smashes it on the ground. Very funny. Then he's meditating in his room, and I loved this part. You know what? I'm just going to go on record right now. I love Crookshanks. All of them. But this actress who's playing Crookshanks is just delightful.
Yeah.
Phillips is great too, don't get me wrong. But Crookshanks is just bringing something. I am enjoying the hell out of this character. So he's meditating in his room, and Crookshanks enters and brings him a letter. She tells him it's from the game warden. And he tells her to read it, and she opens it up, and as she starts with the salutations, he, skip past that. You know, no need for all those formalities. So we don't hear his name yet. But she begins to read the letter and says, the letter reads as such, that when you arrived, we agreed to the terms of your captivity, but your recent behavior suggests your intent to violate those terms. And as such, if this behavior continues, you will face grave consequences. And then she pauses to mention that consequences is underscored, which I love. She's very concerned at this point. And then it goes on to say, please consider this your first and only warning. And thank you again for those delicious tomatoes. Your humble servant, the game warden. Such a peculiar letter, Dean.
Oh, yeah. Such a peculiar person. He's wearing a mask.
Yeah, I want to learn more about this game warden for sure. So we'll talk a little bit more in our predictions, I guess, at the end about where we think that's going. But hilariously, Vite orders Crookshanks to the typewriter and begins dictating his reply. He does say a great line, "We'll see what this devious cur is made of, shall we?" And in his reply, he's very formal. He assures the honorable game warden that his intentions are purely recreational and that he would never imagine to transgress on the terms in which they agreed. And that if he would like to discuss it further, he can repeat his ridiculous accusations in person. And that said, I'm glad you enjoyed the tomatoes, and best wishes and encouragement. Signed, Adrian Vite. There we go. We get
dun, dun,
it.
Dun.
For sure, his name, or who knows, maybe he's not Vite.
Yes.
But for right now, the show's telling us he's Vite.
Yeah, this scene was great. Like you said, he even is not pissed at this point. Like, you can even tell when she's reading the letter, he keeps smirking. Mm-hmm. He seems to have joy in this rebuttal letter in the sense of it's like a fun rivalry of some sort.
He has no fear of this game war.
No, no. But he also doesn't seem like mad about it, whereas he was so mad when he wasn't able to get the buffalo.
Right.
And yeah. And then I love, like you said, I love the way Crookshanks, the actress, is almost like, she's like, oh, that'll show him. That's going to get him. Like, she's like, yes, she master, says, that's the best.
She says, that will have him quaking in his yes, boots, yeah. master. It's a yeah. great line. So funny. And then Bite says he'll hunt again at midnight. And then we see him don his Ozymandias superhero uniform, all purple and gold, complete yeah. little purple mask.
And not quite as fit out as it used to be. A little saggy. He doesn't look quite as, hero-y as he used to.
Interesting that he thinks he needs to wear that to go hunt the buffalo at night. I don't know.
Either that or maybe he's not hunting the buffalo. Maybe he's hunting the game warden.
Ooh, dun, dun, dun. Well, I loved the scene. Great to definitely have the official confirmation that he's Vite, a.k.a. Ozymandias.
Yeah. Also, again, the subtle hints that he is in captivity of some sort in the letter, the terms of his captivity. Yet even the guy writes to him as your humble servant. So, I mean, mm-hmm. even whoever this is, isn't the person who put him in captivity. The concept of the game warden's almost like he's the seeker of the rules, you know, whatever rules that whoever put him here. He's the one that has to make sure. Yeah, he's the referee. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 I wonder if the game warden is a clone as well.
Possibly.
It's strange. All right. So now we're going to move into what I have to say was maybe not my favorite scene, but definitely a scene that was just tense and great. It's opens at outside of the graveyard. Senator Keene is giving a press conference. This was really interesting because there was some interesting questions being sent his way that were a little exposition heavy, but nicely inserted there. One that I really noticed stood out was one reporter asks if he's at all concerned about the Russians building an intrinsic field generator. Mm. Which we know that intrinsic field generator is what Dr. Manhattan gets into and becomes Dr. Manhattan. We saw that happen in right. the play last episode. So now there's speculation that the Russians are building one.
Maybe trying to make
another Dr. Manhattan.
Grad. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Put a pin in that. I have a
Dr.
feeling.
Dr. Moscow.
I have a feeling that line would not have been put in there if that wasn't going to pay off. So we'll see. Maybe it could have been.
So what you're saying is we might be seeing some big red dick later on this season.
Let's all hope so. So Keene has a great, very presidential reply to that. Says the Russians aren't his problem, but the 7th Cavalry is. So he's planning to stay put in Tulsa and get all this figured out. Petey and Lori are watching the senator's speech again off from the sides. And Petey, after the senator is done, Petey says to Lori, well, he's got my vote. To which Lori says, are you even old enough to vote? And then in a very funny way, he says, can I have your autograph now? Yeah. And she says, wow, Petey, that was actually almost funny.
Right.
And she takes both the cups of coffee that he's holding and walks through the full crime investigation into the tomb where the bomber had tunneled through and come out of. And just as she's about to look down the hole there, out pops Angela, who's already been investigating the tunnel, of course. And she's wearing those cool owl glasses again. And Lori offers her the cup of coffee and sits down. And Lori does start off very kindly thanking Angela for saving them. And this is where Angela has that great line saying it was Crawford who jumped on the grave. She just gave him a little push. Lori says, well, we sure as shit can't exhume him now. And Angela's not amused and says, that's not funny. And Lori's like, I really wasn't meaning it to be funny. We were actually going to dig him up discreetly tomorrow and do an autopsy. And then Lori And Angela asks why. What do you think you're going to actually learn? We already know how he died. And Lori starts to outline what she has already learned from her brief time in Tulsa and her investigation, including the wheelchair tracks that she found at the crime scene. And, of course, Angela acts, you know, like she knows nothing about any of this. And she also says that the chief has a secret compartment in his closet.
Right.
And Angela asks, why was Lori looking in his closet? And Lori says, well, when my dad was murdered, they found a secret compartment in his closet. So, you know, I always check. And, of course, you know, her dad was the comedian who was murdered at the beginning of the Watchmen movie. Did he really have a secret compartment in his closet? Was that?
Yeah, it's where he kept, like, the comedian outfit and stuff.
Nice, nice. Yeah. So that was a great tie-in there to the source material. And Angela asks what was in the secret compartment, and Lori turns the tables immediately on her and says, will you tell me? Angela says, well, how the fuck should I know? And Lori says, well, because his wife tells me you were the only person in that room since he died, and you just don't seem like the fainting type. And Angela just kind of stares her down, and Lori says, okay, I'll tell you what was in there. It was just a naked bust, a big naked bust. That's all. But I have a feeling like there was something on that bust, and that you probably took it to cover something up for him. And she says, I don't know, maybe you two were having an affair or something, which makes no sense because your husband is fucking hot. But this much I do know. Men who end up hanging from trees with secret compartments in their closets tend to think of themselves as good guys. And those who protect them think they're good guys too. But here's the thing about me, Sister Knight. I eat good guys for breakfast. And Angela's reaction is perfect. She does this fake little fainting sound, like she's all a flutter. It was great. And, you know, clearly being, you know, smart ass, and then pours the coffee into the hole and leaves. And as she leaves, there's another great, just great visual scene of Lori's face through the lens of the owl glasses that are left there on the ground.
Yeah, I like the scene. I thought it was, again, it was setting up.
I loved
more,
it.
More that you're thinking she's doing exactly what she did to Looking Glass, what she already kind of started doing when she first met Angela. And now she's coming in here again, just saying how much that she knows that you think you know. Right? Yeah. Like, you think I don't know stuff. I know everything. And right when she gives her big, like, you think you're the good guy, I'm gonna fucking get you now. Mm-hmm. And there's that pause where it seems like, uh-oh, she's got Angela beat. And then Angela just, fuck you, bitch, I see right through you. And pours the coffee out, which I feel bad because that was Petey's coffee.
Petey can get more coffee. Poor all right, Petey. Petey's got...
Oh, he's gonna get something hot and wet, all right. But it's not gonna be coffee.
But the perfect time for my husband to have walked in the room as we're about to talk about the scene that I don't believe he has seen yet. So, all right. So the final beat of the joke is the final Lori voiceover. And as this joke is being read, she is unpacking that she's back in her hotel room again with the briefcase, opening it up, the same blue light. We see her pull something out and start to assemble it. And oh my God, I've got in my notes, it's a giant blue pleasuring device. And we do see inside the case, there's also this great Esquire ad. Like, clearly this is a commercial item that's being shown, like being sold as, you know, marketed as a Dr. Manhattan.
Yeah, well, and her, it's the Silk Spectre takes Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I'm sure there's a whole Dr. Manhattan pornography market out there, and why wouldn't there be?
I have the great
ad of Silk Spectre and Dr. Manhattan inside the case.
Yeah, and it's like magnetic, like the ball's magnetically attached to it.
I figured that was the power source.
Yeah, I assumed it kind of was too, but just the look of it, it didn't look like a comfortable giant dildo. I'll tell you that much. Not that I've had very much experiences with them, but
she looked at it longingly, but had another thought. And the next we see her knocking on Petey's door, and then it cuts to the two of them in bed, Petey sleeping soundly with that Lone Ranger mask on, and Lori lying there looking maybe embarrassed, maybe regretful, who knows? They've clearly slept together. Do you think she brought the Dr. Manhattan dildo with her to the room?
I wondered that. I wonder if Petey got the big blue.
I'm just glad we didn't have to see it. Thank you, HBO, for letting us just use our own imagination there.
Yeah, this is very true to her character, especially from the graphic novel. She always, that was kind of what happened with her and Dan, is that she almost used Dan as a relief, like sex to her was a relief or to get her from not thinking of other things.
And Dan is Night Owl.
And because even after the whole squid incident happens, then Dr. Manhattan leaves for Mars again, she basically is like, let's go have some sex. And they go have sex after all this disaster happened.
Well, we know that she's an emotionally detached character. So I guess sex is her only, we see that in the beats of the movie too, that's really her only known way, I guess, for an escape. I don't know. I don't know if her mother was super sexual, how she came to be that way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think she was, because she even had in the graphic novels, she found little, what they called Tijuana Bibles, these little like porno comic strips made off of the original Silk Spectre, like back in the 50s and stuff. So being in the adult industry is nothing new, for the Jupiter ladies.
Sure. And listen, to each their own, man. If she wants to walk around, but she's treating that briefcase like it is like a prized possession.
Well, I mean,
and if it's being
did you see that thing? Yeah. It's a blue ribbon winner. All right.
Well, I will be very curious to see the fallout of what happens the day after there with her and Petey, but how are they ever going to be able to face each other? Anyway, the third part of this joke is also going on throughout all of the scenery. And the joke is now pretty much ends here with, after, of course, God has sent this third hero to hell, now a woman is standing before God. And God says, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are. And the woman says, I'm the little girl that threw the brick up in the air. And a sound from above, a loud sound comes from above, and the brick lands on God's head and kills him immediately. It's too late. He never saw it coming. Game over. He's dead. And where does God go when he dies? He goes to hell. And we do see now she's in the phone booth again. This is, this is our bookend scene here of her relaying this whole joke into this receiver here of this Mars phone booth. And the phone booth transmission interrupts her at this point in the joke and says, you have 55 seconds to complete your transition. And then Lori starts to get a little sentimental here and starts to say, I don't understand why I keep coming to this phone booth, to these phone booths, and telling you all these stupid jokes. It's not like you ever had a sense of humor, and you're probably never going to hear this anyway. Sometimes it's just nice to pretend the assholes down here still think you give a shit, even though you've been on another planet for 30 years. And then she gets very sad and tears roll down her eyes. And she says, but we're not really worth giving a shit about anyway. And that's when she's cut off and told that her message will reach Mars in 40 seconds. And she puts the receiver down and says, good night, John. Walks out of the phone booth. And barely missing her, a car drops from the sky right next to her, smashes into the ground, and she looks up, sees an orange glowing light in the sky flash at her. We presume this is Mars, of course. She does, for sure. And she begins laughing hysterically, and we cut to credits. And I should say that here in this scene again, another scene of downtown Decatur Square and the Iberian Pig. Watchmen fans, if you're in Decatur is a suburb of Atlanta. It's kind of in East Atlanta. So it's a great little area to visit. If you ever come to Atlanta, you can go straight to the Iberian Pig and you'll be right there in a scene from Watchmen. But so, yeah, this car was Angela's car. Yes, the one that Will was taken in the last.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure. Will was not in the car.
I didn't see him.
Lori thinks that this is Manhattan dropping the car, right?
Yeah, I think that's the assumption you're supposed to make. And they do show that flash, mm-hmm. which looks like it is, you know, and in fact, they even, you can see the red little dot up there before it flashes. So it makes it seem like it's Mars pulsing or something. Mm-hmm. But
she interprets this as a sign from Dr. Manhattan. I'm not 100% sure I interpret it that way,
but
she was almost killed literally by space junk.
And it was about 40 seconds after she got off the phone.
So yeah. I've heard that it was timed exactly 40 seconds. And also after she just talks about the brick falling from the sky and killing God.
Right.
And here comes this big thing that could have killed her had it landed on her.
She
barely misses her.
Yeah.
Barely misses her. Never saw it coming. So some great tie in there to this joke. Do you want to talk about the joke? Do you want to talk about what we think this car dropping possibly means?
Just the only other thing about the joke again is that I guess it comes down to who do you think she means as God? Is God, like we said, if it's justice, if it's society, if it's a happy ending, maybe, and she feels like she's outwitted everybody and she's the last one still kind of going off doing anything, but she certainly doesn't seem happy.
Yeah. I would say that, yeah, like God is fate in her mind and like the shitty fate that's been dealt these three, you know, quote unquote heroes before her. And really she fancies herself as the ultimate hero, the one they never saw coming. Right. She's the one who was able to take down God and throw the brick. And furthermore, this is a joke within a joke,
right?
Which I have come to understand is actually a real thing in joke telling, where it's a misdirect. You start with one joke, act like you've messed it up, go into a completely different joke, and then bring the punchline back around from the original joke.
Right.
So I love that design here. The joke design was brilliantly done, brilliantly written. And fun to think about for sure. And I definitely don't think, I think we can take the three heroes at face value.
Yeah.
She was intending them to be, and then that she's referring to herself as a little girl. So,
right.
Yeah, I think God could just be what fate has dealt them, you know.
Yeah, it could even be maybe the people, like the people put Dan in jail. Mm. They basically they stopped worshiping and kind of dismissed Vite and even have kind of forsaken Dr. Manhattan as leaving them, whereas she's now an FBI agent and she's supposed to be protecting, and maybe the people are the ones who are actually, even they are going to go to hell eventually, like the world's going to hell type of thing.
Yeah, that's good. Good metaphor.
Yeah, so what do you think the car?
I think if it was dropped by Dr. Manhattan, then I think we should be believing that it was Dr. Manhattan who lifted Will up in the first place.
Yeah, but he wouldn't use a giant magnet, would he?
Who knows?
Well, it's Dr. Manhattan. He has the ability to just like move things. Mm-hmm.
So I think whoever dropped the car is the same person who lifted the car.
Yes, I absolutely do too.
So then they want Lori. Then this was actually maybe an attempt on Lori's life that she's misinterpreting. Now the flashing Mars could still be a sign from Dr. Manhattan.
It's just a coincidence.
Could be that Dr. Manhattan interfered and prevented the car from dropping on her.
Right.
And so, you know, that's what that flashing was like. Oh, okay. I just saved you from almost dying there. So it could be somebody nefarious who's got Will and who's maybe trying to kill her by dropping the car. Could be that the car, literally like the title, she was killed by space junk. Could be that the car, it was time for it to randomly fall.
Yeah. Yeah. And I almost think maybe it was someone dropping off a clue right in front of her face.
I don't know, but I do know we will get answers.
Yeah.
So our great fan Roby, shout out to Roby. He sent us an email. He sent
to the mailbox.
Yes, that's right. We'll open up the old mailbox. He summed up all of his tweets in one email, which I really appreciated, Roby. Thank you. Keep writing. He has some great questions and some great talking points here. Some we've already discussed, but some we haven't. So he says he believes that now we understand the use of the many deceased Phillips tanning away. So he thinks perhaps those charred bodies were being used for to create the skins for that spacesuit. I think that that's very apt. I would believe that. No?
No, it shows pigs hanging around. So I'm thinking that first it's pig skin. I think the bodies are still going to be used for something later on. If we're to know that this is supposed to, and Lindelof said that this is supposed to be like the black freighter of this Watchman. In the original Black Freighter, he literally ties a bunch of dead bodies together to make a raft to float in the ocean on.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
So who knows? Maybe I don't know if it would be that bonkers, but maybe he's going to make a giant spaceship out of dead bodies or something.
Like he's trying to plan his escape. He's trying to get out of whatever this captivity is without letting his captor know that he's trying to do it. He's trying to be covert about it because he's not allowed to do anything that's not recreational, I guess, there in this make-believe world he's living in. Roby goes on to say, I wonder who the Kerr is with enough power to make Vite agree to the arrangements of his isolation. Indeed. I have, unless it's Dr. Manhattan himself, do you have any other speculation? Or it is, as we discussed, it's another clone or some sort of entity that's been put there to enforce the rules.
I think it's either Dr. Manhattan and he's on Mars in some kind of bubble, or I kind of mentioned, I thought this, not necessarily with him, but I thought we might end up finding that she's a very bad person too. Maybe Lady True has something to do with him being captured.
Well, as we remember from episode one, where we get the scene of Dr. Manhattan on the news on Mars and he's blowing up a castle that looks exactly like Vite's, I think that is a definite sign that he's got Vite on Mars, right? Like that could have been that demolition or whatever was happening there could have been the foundation or the beginnings of whatever he was building, or it could have been the end. Yeah. There has been some speculation. Lindelof says this in the podcast, for those who aren't going to take the time to go listen to it, that they filmed all the Adrian Vite stuff first because it was done in Norway or whatever. Right. And they had to have a certain time of year or whatever. And so, so they had all those parts written first. Right. Where was I going with it? Oh. And that there is a significance there with the cakes and the candles and all get answered. So I believe that your theory could be correct, Dean, that what we're seeing here with these Vite scenes is actually not caught up to the current timeline in Tulsa. So maybe what we saw on the news is the future of what's going to happen to Vite. That was Manhattan blowing the shit up.
Either that or maybe
Vite under control.
If Vite is able to escape, maybe he doesn't need that place anymore.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Manhattan's not there at all.
We're going to figure it out.
Okay. So, all right. I know we got to wrap up here. Let me just finish up Roby's email. It says, clearly Vite did not die on Earth. He either got to Mars, got to Dr. Manhattan, or died in space and is maybe in a buffalo hide spacesuit. Ha ha, Roby. he says, I have a suspicion Keen is manipulating, if not leading, the Calvary. Why did he arrange his kidnapping? It's all about getting elected. One trigger-happy FBI agent put that plan in danger. So if that was all staged there at the funeral for Keen to be taken hostage, that certainly makes...
Well, he definitely makes sure he's up in the press and, you know, answering questions afterwards. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how he was talking about the DOPA thing with Lori earlier, but we didn't mention that he does go pretty heavy into, well, they're about to... other cities want to do this too. And I think he even says Atlanta, or maybe Orlando, and Atlanta and New Orleans. And it says a couple cities that are... thinking about going to this masked cop
too,
because it works. Like, we've seen crime go down, and I think that's really why he needs, or at least what he's
pushing to her is I need this fixed because this is going to be kind of like my big platform to run on. The fact that I can swell the or quell these lawless cities almost and drive down crime in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Senator Keene, more to come on him. And you, I know you said, and we probably don't have time to go into it today, but I know you said there's a lot of history about him and especially his father and his tie with Judd Crawford on the PDPedia files.
Right.
So be sure to check those out. We'll discuss those more in depth, hopefully on our next episode. I still haven't had a chance to read them yet, and they added more content again this week, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there were three this week, and there's one pretty good one that does actually make some more connection between Keene Sr. and Judd.
Okay. Do you want to go into it now, or?
I'll give you a quick thing and then you all can look. It talks about the painting, that we saw. It talks about how that painting is a hand-me-down. It's been handed down from several people, and it was actually a fake painting because the story is that the artist, and I looked it up, this is a real painting. But right. The story that's in this thing is kind of, you know, it's alternate history. But sure. The artist had given the painting to somebody and then was trying to sell it to a museum or something. And the person he gave it to refused to give it up to him or allow him to sell it. And so the guy realized, well, I'm still good. I still have sketches and stuff. So basically he started painting reproductions of this to sell. And because he couldn't plagiarize it since he had like sold the rights of it to this other guy, he flipped the title of the painting. Cause originally it's called Comanche Horsemanship, whatever the opposite of the title
feats
was.
Martial Feats of Comanche. No, that's the name.
That's the name. But so right. It's like Comanche Horsemanship of Martial Feats or something.
Or one of those words was left.
So basically he flips the title and then says, like, it's funny how just a slight juxtaposition of the words can circumvent copyright laws. Then again, this painting apparently was handed down. It talks about how it depicts that we don't want to forget the savagery of what we've come from and blah, blah, blah. But the important thing is Keene had it. He handed it down to Judd Crawford and he makes a comment about how every leader of our order has always hung this painting. And they don't say what the order is, but then he signed like in Zeus's name or by Zeus or something like that. And there's this weird insignia that's like an eye insignia. So it's some kind of secret. They're in some kind of secret order. Mm. And I don't know if it's supposed to be the clan, since obviously as the clan robe, or if it's some other kind of secret society, but it does hint that Judd was involved with some, you know, Illuminati type shit.
And I wanted to say, we know for sure Angela took those robes because she pulled them out and showed them to Will when she. Right. So I heard another podcast talking about, like, where do you think the robes are? And I was like, wait, Angela has them.
Yeah, she took them.
Yeah. And I know we saw
that. They even show in the promo that she's going to show them to Looking Glass.
Looking Glass, yeah. So I was glad. Not everybody watches the promo. So there are people who stay pure and don't watch the promo, which is crazy to me. Like, I'm so jonesing for the next episode that of course I watch the promo. Last comment here from Roby is kind of funny. He says, I thought the blue device was a communicator until it was put together. I don't know what kind of communicators you're looking at, Roby, but yeah.
The future kind. You got to stick it in somewhere and then you just communicate.
All happy transmissions, of course.
All right. Well, thanks, Roby, for mailing in.
Yes.
Always glad to make you part of our podcast.
And if you would like to have your... Well, is there anything else we should say before we wrap up?
Nah, I think we said everything. Yeah,
if you would like to have your emails read on Mike TV, and, you know, who knows, might even get another visit from the great Tim Andrews. We'll try to get him to read some next time. Hopefully he'll get caught up on the show soon. But we're just glad he's watching it.
That's right.
Remember to email us, miketvpodcast@gmail.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at miketv1 or talk to me at rockdale_tiger. If you want to hear me or hear my musings or my theories get talked about by another podcast, go find the Watchmen Watch podcast by Comic Book Club.
They've hit my questions up for the past 2 weeks, so I've been mentioned on there, so you can find me there. If you want to hear Tim Andrews and Jeff Lieboff berate me and make fun of me, check out Radio Labyrinth podcast, because I tend to ruffle feathers online there as well. So,
yes, you're doing a good job, Dean. Yeah, it's awesome here.
Keeping us in the know.
Yeah, it's awesome hearing the comic book club guys talk about you, read your tweets and questions. And there's some really good questions. So that's a good podcast to listen to, too. I highly recommend it. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Dean. We will talk to you again next week when we cover episode 4. Can't wait.
All right. Keep watching. Bye.
Bye.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.